The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
I'm delighted to welcome my panel. We have someone who was around long enough in politics. She was actually in the Dáil the same time as me. Frances Fitzgerald has been senator, TD, MEP, and of course in a number of ministerial roles, former Taoiseach Minister for Justice, the Department of Children, Department of Enterprise, and we're delighted to welcome her. Whether she'll confirm she's running for the presidency in November, nobody knows. We're also delighted to be joined by Mark Hennessy, who is Ireland and Britain editor with the Irish Times, but of course has formerly been London editor, news editor, and he's even around long enough that I, for a long time, were we even with the Examiner at one stage?
I was.
Yes, indeed. I remember he was a normal mortal political hack looking for gossips and morsels of information, but there's nothing he doesn't know about politics. And we're delighted to also be joined by Philip Ryan, who is a political editor with the entire media group, which of course the media house, which covers the Sunday Independent as well as the Indo and so much more. And of course, he is the author of the book Leo, which gave insights into our previous Taoiseach. So I just scanned through the lead stories on page one of the Sunday Independent. Gabby has a story, coalition talks ramp up with the climate crux issue. It seems in that story that now that the Greens are no longer in the room, how they're going to deal with carbon taxes and other issues remains unclear. Lots of snowy photographs. The Sunday Times leads with Coalition Blue, 37 million in 2 years on consultants. This is a story by the political editor Hugh O'Connell. And a photograph of almost a prayerful Bono, so caught up in his own self-importance, makes me laugh. But anyway, he is the first Irish person since Mary Robinson to get this US Presidential Medal of Freedom Award. Good luck to him. The Business Post leads with an interview they have with Jack Chambers, the Minister of Finance. And of course, as the Taoiseach changes, he will be going out of that role. And of course, tomorrow is the formal publication of the Exchequer returns for the outturn of 2024. Will it be any different to that set out in the budget? It sets out some of the risks, stagnant EU and Trump trade war. A gender gap widens in big tech firms, Meta and Dell. And the Irish Mail on Sunday, bank kept lending to Lynn after warnings. This is Michael Lynn, who you'll be aware was brought home from Brazil, is in prison now, that basically the lender was warned he should have been reported to the Law Society and kept lending. You're welcome, one and all. Francis, you've only to ring Simon, your protégé, to find out what's actually happening. We don't need to read the Sunday papers. What's your take on government formation talks?
Well, obviously there's been a week off. So this is, I would say, crunch week in terms of all the decisions that have to be taken. The papers are focusing on this issue of climate. But what I would say in relation to that, I mean, you have Micheál Martin, who's been in cabinet for 4.5 years. You have Simon, who's been for 9. There's other ministers who've been part and parcel of the, you know, the policy on climate. So I don't see it as big an issue in terms of dealing with it. I mean, the more challenging issue, I think, if government ends up being Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and the independents, will be, you know, the decision making around the implementation of the green agenda. And you're even seeing in Europe quite a pushback in relation to that. So what's happening here in terms of taking more account of agriculture, more account of the challenges farmers are facing and so on, how you actually implement the Green Deal, I think there's going to be huge focus. And we're going to have to put a lot of money into, you know, the new technologies and create jobs there as well. But I think this week is crunch week. And I imagine that you have to remember as well that even when there's an agreement, all the parties, both parties, have to send it out to their members. So, for example, in Fine Gael, yeah, you have to have a ballot to see whether or not the members accept it. And I think Fianna Fáil have to have a conference. So there's a way to go yet. And My understanding is that there hasn't been much discussion at all about, you know, the different responsibilities for different departments at this point or changes. But in both manifestos, there was lots of discussion about, you know, a new Department of Domestic Affairs, a new Department of Infrastructure. So there's going to have to be a lot of, I would say, engagement so that both parties feel they've got, you know, a certain amount that they were looking for in terms of the formation of the different departments.
Yeah, and so basically, Mark, let's because I find politicians or even former politicians are a lot more reticent about what can actually be said. But so my understanding, what's agreed, is the next election will be in November 29. Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil have agreed an 8-7 split if they don't have to give a cabinet post to the regional independents. There will be three super juniors. There'll be one for each party, and that. Basically, the Senate will be shared between Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, that the two parties are going to do a deal together and then involve the regional independents, who clearly want a cabinet post. In terms of, do you think, 2 weeks on Wednesday is the 22nd when they'd all resume, do you think it'll be on schedule insofar as Micheál will be elected Taoiseach, the cabinet will be appointed, or what's your sense of all that?
Well, you would certainly hope that that would be the case because, frankly, we're not in a position where we should be delaying any of these issues. And having said that, I think Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael are capable of coming up with a deal that all of the people know each other, etc. The inclusion of this regional independence group is an unknown we don't know how that's going to play out in time. Do they actually stick in the point of getting a cabinet place? If they do, every other calculation that has been made will have to be unravelled, etc.
Yeah.
So we don't know. Michael Lowry has been very clever in shunting Verona Murphy into the Ciarán Cóirleas position. I think a decision that everybody will come to regret in time, but we'll see. Nevertheless, it has sorted out a problem because there would definitely have been relationship issues amongst the regional independence group if you had somebody like Verona around that table. And Lowry, whatever else people say about him, is no fool. And he has sorted out an internal regional independence issue by ensuring that she is Ciarán Cóirleas. In terms of the split on policies and stuff like that, I think...
And the programme for government and departmental reform. What I'm looking at there, what's the difference between the two parties? It's not a cigarette paper between them. But Fine Gael clearly wanted a Department of Infrastructure and Fianna Fáil clearly wanted to take the migration issue from the Department of Children back to justice in a new Department of Domestic Affairs, like the Home Secretary.
And the latter bit certainly makes a lot of sense. Now, maybe I'm missing it, but I don't get a sense that the Department of Infrastructure idea is gathering momentum because we hear talk of energy going to enterprise and other things. That's not the sort of thing that we should be hearing if the Department of Infrastructure was a real live contender. And there is a very strong argument behind creating one, and equally there is a strong argument behind not creating it. I mean, firstly, if you were to try and do it, it would take 18 months to put together a department of that nature, given the various bits coming from so disparate across the way. But we do have to do something on that. I mean, you saw the report the other day saying that planning cases are now taking twice as long as they were previously. And this is despite the fact that everybody accepts that there's a crisis, that everybody who's in their positions is trying to do the right thing in the right order, but stuff isn't coming out at the other end, and so I don't know how they sort that. But by shunting energy, for instance, into enterprise, there's an argument in favour of that because of the whole issue of data centres that we were talking about before we came into studio. But equally, there's an argument behind not doing it because, you know, if you're going to try and ramp up housing, one of the main problems we have is the supply of services to developers and to land that is already zoned to ensure that they can go ahead. Now, that's more of a problem at the water end than it is at the electricity end. But nevertheless, the two, to an extent, do go together.
But do you think it will be on the 22nd that we'll get the government?
I don't know whether it'll be on the 22nd because I think we're going to have various dramas. But let's put it this way. If it's not on the 22nd, there's a legitimate question to ask of every senior politician politician in the place saying, what in the name of Jesus do you lot think you're doing?
Okay. Philip, it's your paper has the story from Gabby with the emphasis on, you know, the Greens are the room, the climate may be, you know, they may need expert help on it. What's your overall sense?
Yeah, look, I think at the end of the day, some of the stuff that Eamon Ryan and the Green Party have baked into kind of legislation for all intents and purposes, and they would have boasted about this while they were in government, that senior advisors and ministers would say that it'll take decades to unwind some of the things that Greens have put into society. And the legal cases and legal binding agreements that they've put in place. But at the same time, the independents are going to come in and they're going to be asking, look, we're in here, we're rural, we're regional, we're trying to undo essentially all that stuff. So you're going to have to make some commitments between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, and it'll probably suit them to some intents and purposes. Mm. Can't see the carbon tax being unwinded. It's it seems like that's one that's in there. Yes, it goes up every year. Yes, it's an expensive one for people who are impacted by whether you're driving trucks or heating your house or whatever way it impacts you. But look, that's where it's going to be at this week. It's going to be on those various different issues around the climate.
What do you think will be the most difficult tension issue? Is it the departmental reform? Will it actually be if Kenny or someone is made a full minister, whether it becomes 8-6-1 or whatever?
No,
I see. Parity of esteem, pro rata, you name it.
Well, the one I'd say that is pointing out to Jack Chambers this morning as he's sitting over his bowl of Cheerios or whatever, is you letting him know that he's been kicked out of the Department of Finance after just a few short months.
That'll but that's a big disappointment. But that's now. Whoever is Taoiseach, the Minister of Finance, has to be from the other party.
But that's when it was a proper parity of esteem. I'd say Fianna Fáil would be pushing very hard to keep that department and leaving the Department of Public Expenditure with Fine Gael at this point.
That sounds like senior-junior partnership. But
they don't like to admit it, but look, it is what it is.
That's interesting, yeah.
Yeah, but I can't see Jack Chambers leaving the Department of Finance at this point, no, because look.
On the other hand, I'd say Pascal was delighted to hear you this morning.
But it's just become such a on the occasions that it's happened twice. Yeah. It was almost automatic because there's two departments, and you could rename the Department of Public Expenditure, the Department of Infrastructure. You could do that.
Yeah. But with Labour and Fine Gael, it was Taoiseach and Finance Minister.
Yeah,
they both had, Fine Gael had both. Yeah, and they went Michael Noonan in Finance. Yeah. And now the numbers were a little bit different there in that instance. The bigger issues that are going to come down the line, look, there's not a huge ideological difference between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael on a lot of these things. They'll agree some sort of 2-to-1 tax package versus spending, that'll be brought in again. The departmental thing, the infrastructure, people in Fine Gael at a senior level are kind of, they've given up on that one. There may be some sort of agency, oversight agency that's created to oversee this type of thing. There's some talk about the NTMA, the National Treasury Management Agency,
just
being drafted in.
I was doing this Chatham House thing, which is no longer Chatham. The CFOs of all the utilities in the semi-states, right? And so New Era was set up in that very thing, an overarching thing. And one of the CFOs said, you know what, New Era and Bulmer Cider haven't got nothing added but time. And
of course, that's probably also an issue in relation to climate.
Yeah.
That the timing of the implementation of the Green Deal, you're seeing this in Europe as well, may be one of the ways of dealing with some of the challenges and the tensions, you know, that you'd be given longer timelines. Now, Ursula wouldn't be very keen on that at a European level, but I think it may be one of the ways it can be, managed here. But I think the key issue now going into this government is actually economic stability.
Is it not housing? I mean,
housing and the infrastructure.
We're now going to see the outturn of this year is about 33,000 houses. So this is something that they can't evade. Year on year, did you build? Because the new targets have agreed, building up 60,000 a year. What are you expecting terms of a game changer on housing?
But like Francis is saying, though, if the rest of Europe is worrying about something completely different, could be defence, could be security, and we're sitting around worrying about carbon taxes and building houses, that's not going to weigh up. Like, who knows what's going to happen over the next couple of years?
It was the electorate I was thinking of.
But
the key point is that, you know, we are such an outlier in terms of our economic growth. If we can keep that going, you can begin to deal with the infrastructure issues, you can deal with the housing, we have to deal with these issues as if they're a crisis, the same way COVID was. So, I mean, there has to be some imagination in these talks over the next 10 days, 2 weeks.
There is.
There has to be a new initiative in relation to housing, in relation to disability, yeah, childcare. I mean, it can't be business as usual. Therefore, how it's dealt with at a government level, we all know that people get into silos. How are you going to break those silos if you're going to deliver on these issues? I mean, that's a critical thing for the negotiators to be figuring out. So you can really make a difference.
It is, but
the public won't forgive this government if they don't. No,
they won't.
With these issues.
But equally, to sort out housing and the other issues you talked about, but particularly housing and the point you were making about COVID-style changes, that's absolutely right. But there's no appetite for that. We talk a certain war, and then we actually behave very differently. You could sort out a lot of the issues surrounded by housing by having rapidly accelerated processes in a number of different areas, in terms of compulsory purchase, in terms of planning, in terms of a whole lot of other things. But how would you do that and actually end up in a way whereby you're not going to be in court for the next 2 years? So we've created a system with checks and balances, all of which were done for good reasons, but which have a consequent outcome that it takes ages to get anything done. And changing a minister in housing or whatever, none of those kind of, I mean, you've been in government, or two of you have
been
in government.
That's kind of a hopeless scenario. No,
I'm not,
you know what I mean?
I'm not saying...
Like, honestly, if elections are to mean anything, or, you know, promises to the public, or saying we're going to build 55,000 houses a year, it's an imperative now, Mark,
I'm not saying...
Why wasn't
it
an imperative over the last 10, 12 years?
Yeah, but the point is that if COVID-style changes are necessary to actually fundamentally alter the arithmetic, they're extremely difficult to do, and you have to be able to bear the political cost that will come with doing them. And you actually have to go out to the Irish people and say, we have a housing crisis, we need to accelerate X, Y, and Z, and consequently we are bringing forward legislation which will deny your or limit your rights to object to planning, will make it easier to compulsory purchase land or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Now, you know how quickly people will start screaming the minute any politician...
Well, Keir Starmer is facing into those issues head on. He is actually going to sites and say, we're going to build 8,500 houses here. But there's a very interesting...
But without the legal background that we have accumulated here over the last couple
of
years.
No, and Dermot O'Leary of Good Buddies, who was on the Housing Commission, has a very interesting piece. He said it's actually quite straightforward. To build 300,000 houses over 5 years, you need finance and you need land, and it needs to be zoned.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
Welcome back. Ivan filling in for Anton, and my newspaper panel this morning is Francis Fitzgerald, Mark Hennessy of the Irish Times, and Philip Ryan of the Independent Group. And just some of your texts. In addition to climate alarmism, we now have weather alarmism. Are the panel aware of the rules of both FF and FG require a vote of the membership? Yes, we alluded to that. The permanent government needs to be halved. Too many behind desks and too few in every front line. FG and FF do not have the backbone to tackle uncontrolled immigration, which is driving up housing demand. Housing crises are endemic worldwide, not just unique to Ireland. And Ivan, Happy New Year. Your guest, Mark Hennessy, sounds remarkably like Willie Mullins. Willie is a good friend of mine. I think Willie's a little bit more soft-spoken. Ivan, explain why the government and councils aren't buying the empty rundown houses above shop flats around the country, doing them up and moving people from hotels into them. It's actually very interesting. In provincial rural Ireland, there's a 35% vacancy rate in town centres, both at shop floor level and above. Let's take an international perspective on what are the kind of SWOT analysis that Ireland faces in terms of challenges and opportunities. Francis, obviously, Trump 2.0, we have, you know, changes of government. We have an imploding French and German government situation. What do you think will be the sort of headwinds and tailwinds for Ireland?
Well, clearly the wars are, you know, it's huge. If you're looking at it from a kind of a Brussels perspective, European perspective, the ongoing war in Ukraine is costing a fortune, huge implications for the budget. Everybody is spending more on defence and security. I think Ireland's reputation has been impacted by our own approach, actually, even though we're doing our best to contribute in the ways that we can. The geopolitics of Europe changed completely in terms of Trump coming back. despair in many ways in Europe with him. You know, Trump Mark II is going to be very different to the first time. You know, he's much better prepared. He has very key people around him. And we know their attitudes to tariffs, you know, burn, baby, burn. We know attitude to the environment. You know, the whole impact that's going to have on the politics of Europe. Europe is in a very bad state from a competitive point of view. We know that. We're not keeping innovation in Europe in the way that we need to. It's going to America and China. We've got to crack that one, crack the competitiveness. That issue of regulation and over-regulation, heavily towards the end of the last parliament, heavily criticised for that.
A lot of the media focus is actually on the conflict, and you can see from a humanitarian crisis on the Middle East.
Yes. Yeah.
But just focusing on the potential for an end, what is it, something like 600,000 Ukrainians have died, the 2 million migrating more. There was an expectation that the art of the deal with Trump, that he might actually try and say, well, look, we're not going to underwrite this and maybe try and cut some sort of deal with Putin, which maybe the Ukrainians might or might not want. What's your sense of that conflict?
Well, my sense is that, I mean, the worry is that what Trump will do, and he, you know, the art of the deal, is that he will use power and influence, the arms that, and the money from America, that he will use it in order to get a deal done. I think that's quite possible. The problem will be that he will want it to be, or the most likely scenario is, you know, wherever the Russians are now, the Russians stay. And that's going to be very unacceptable to Ukraine.
Crimea, Mark II.
Exactly. Yeah. And a huge worry about that. And whether or not, you know, that is where it will end up. Because everybody wants peace. I mean, as I say, the impact on the EU. I mean, my Eastern European friends are terrified that the next step is Moldova and moving further in. They have no faith whatsoever. The Finns are worried. They're building up their defences along the border. So, I mean, my Eastern European friends, I have a friend who was a defence minister in Latvia. She says, I want to apologise for not convincing the West about how dangerous Putin is. And they are like completely, like the whole nexus in Europe has moved to the east.
Okay, but
it's moved to the east. But
is this a conflict Ukraine can win?
It's not a conflict that Ukraine can win, but equally any Trump deal is going to be a bad deal both for Ukraine and it's going to be a bad deal for Europe because it is going to encourage Putin to other adventures. And if we were sitting in a radio station in Riga this morning, the first half an hour of our conversation would have been about the looming threat of war on the continent of Europe beyond Ukraine. So in many ways, the debate here, we are all collectively living in cloud cuckoo land. We have a defence debate that is a nonsense, and I'm not suggesting that we join NATO or, you know, whatever, any of that kind of stuff. But what I am suggesting is that we need for once in our lives to actually wake up to the fact that we can't protect our own national interests, cables coming into Ireland, intelligence gathering that's going on, you know, all of the we've lived in a land of delusion for years.
Are we freeloading?
Of course we're freeloading.
Absolutely.
I mean, and we've been doing it for decades.
And even that, like, is it being a neutral country, does that mean that Putin, if he does decide to move further west, he'll just suddenly go, oh, we'll leave Ireland alone there.
Well, we have the submarines off the west coast.
I know.
Yeah, but it's not a question of thinking in terms of invasion. It's a question in terms of thinking of influence, at least at this side of Europe. I mean, if you look at the way in which the Finns are being affected and the Baltics are being affected with cables being dragged up off the ground and all the rest of it, some of the most important cables in the world land
Absolutely.
In Ireland.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And we have no ability to even know what's going on off our coast. I mean, okay, if we can't have fully equipped ships because we have numbers and pay and all the rest of it, you know, you look at what's happening with drones in the UK. It is possible to police Irish waters with large, high-quality drones that you would actually know what's going on 300 or 400 miles off the Irish coast and at least then be able to...
But Mark, just on the imminent prospect, I mean, Trump had a line that every time Zelensky visited the White House, it cost the states another $30 billion in military aid. He's clearly minded to stop spending that money. And he's quite isolationist in his approach. How do you think that might play out?
He's quite isolationist, but the bit that he never understood or wanted to, that $30 billion was being spent with American manufacturers. It was being spent in states filled with Republican Trump-voting workers. working for General Dynamics and every other Raytheon and every other defense company that you can think of. And anybody in the American military knows that the damage that has been done to the Russian war machine, as it were, in Ukraine using American money has been very cheaply bought from the point of view of American money. But he's no interest in it. And if he thinks he can go in and do some sort of
a ceasefire, obviously, and he would be looking, like people have texted in, Putin has said he has no interest in moving past Ukraine. This is just, another says, this is just scaremongering. Russia, aren't you going to start invading Finland or any other NATO country? And there actually is a line in the sand of, you know, Ukraine is not a NATO country, but if he attacked a NATO country, it's a whole different ballgame. Do you accept that?
Yeah, but it's not, as I said earlier, I mean, we have to think in terms of conflict and war in a much wider context. It's not about necessarily about tanks coming onto your lawn. It's about all the other things. You look at the way in which politics in Moldova has been affected. You look at the way in which Georgia has suffered Russian interference. You look at the way in which elections in on the continent of Europe, and God knows perhaps here, were being impacted by Russian bots and whatever. There's a whole variety of tools.
But we are living in a world that's moving towards an authoritarian.
So, Phil, the question is the external environment. Mm. And of course, a lot of people say the biggest threat from Trump is that our US corporations, you take the top 10, be it your Microsoft, your Googles, your Amazons, your Apples, followed by the pharma of your Pfizer's, MSD, Johnson & Johnson, that we are in the crosshairs of him trying to reshore that. And that is actually a real Irish threat.
Yeah, no, that's a big one. And I was writing about this during the week as well. The other one, and it came up on the Ditch website too, is this idea of us imposing the Occupied Territories Bill and boycotting certain goods coming from the occupied West Banks of Palestine. That's the impact that may have on companies based here, especially if they're headquartering but have setups here as well, that there is a law in America that bans companies from dealing with or complying with unsanctioned boycotts in other countries. And that might have an impact as well, where those countries might go, okay, we're not actually able to operate under these circumstances too. So, and you can't really blame him on that one, where he wants to bring back money made by American companies into America. Like we would do the same, I think, if it was elsewhere. Yes, we're a small, open economy. We rely on that. But there has always been this unspoken thing that we are kind of, less so now, but we are kind of a tax haven of sorts in the world. We're not the Cayman Islands or Belize, but we are a form of that. And that's how we make our money. And that's why we have all these huge corporation taxes to spend on this, that and the other. And this is why we kind of turn our back when Apple tried to give us 13 billion or don't want to give us 13, the EU want to give us 13 billion. So there is that aspect. But just going back to the war side of things as well. And when you did the hypocrisy, I just find nauseating, where you have Trump, Biden, they're all putting money into Ukraine, or Trump at least giving out about sending all the money to Ukraine. But during the week, we just saw as well a further 8 billion of military aid or military goods was supplied to Israel to essentially wipe out a people in the Middle East, in Gaza. And that continues on. And it's that hypocrisy that, and the people see this across the world, and especially in the continent of Europe, if people are trying to get some sort of collegiality across the board and want people to prepare for a defence scenario, when you have that sort of hypocrisy, it's going to be hard to get that community.
How do you explain the unswerving support of the EU and the US for Israel? Is it guilt over the Holocaust? Is it Jewish money and influence in American politics? But I would have thought in Europe that is less significant. And, you know, Ireland's attempts to recognise the state of Palestine, to make various things, have actually been reduced to gesture politics, because outside of Spain, and I think of Sweden, one other country, it has had no traction whatsoever.
It's an intriguing question, Ivan, and I think the answer is probably a little bit of all the factors that you mentioned. I was amazed at the beginning of the Middle East war in Europe, how you could hardly get a point in about Palestine, and that's the truth. UNRWA was seen as, you know, Hamas, actually. Mm. They were always giving out about the agenda, the curricula, their support to schools. Germany in particular I mean, it was almost impossible to get the German delegation, even in our own grouping, to talk about the other side.
Why do you think that?
It's like, definitely an
45,000 people it's, dead.
It is extraordinary. It's definitely historic. No doubt in Germany it's historic. It's making up for, you know, what happened there. I think the financial side is huge in America. I mean, the political influence that comes with the finance that's available to the community is enormous.
Mark, those summits where they're trying to agree just even a text to say there should be a ceasefire.
Yeah. And, yet
and you can't get the French and Germans and others involved, the Austrians involved in these things. Like, it's bizarre.
And the other thing is the international order has broken down completely, rule of law. I mean, you know, the international courts, any of the UN.
The UN is impotent in all
totally.
Of this.
Yeah.
Well, it is, but I mean the West has hugely damaged its own reputation by what happened in Gaza. There's no doubt about that whatsoever. And equally what Ireland has been trying to do, and, you know, it is wonderfully admirable in so many ways. But we do need to be aware of the fact, and I'm not saying this to argue that we should be doing otherwise, but we do need to be aware of the fact that these kind of actions come with a cost.
They do.
And we need to be prepared to pay that cost. I'm not saying we shouldn't.
A commercial economic
Absolutely.
Cost.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's no doubt about that, because there are Republican figures in the US who are banging on about Ireland and are allegedly, quote-unquote, pro-Hamas and pro-terrorism mm-hmm. and all the rest. It's not being seen as being anti-genocide. It's being seen as being pro-terror. Mm-hmm. That's the way that it's been viewed. And it's not just the Jewish lobby in the US, and which has historically, you know, with the IPAC and the other political action committees and all of the rest of it. It is a powerful voice on Capitol Hill. It has been for decades. But it goes beyond that. You have Republican evangelicals, you know, people who believe in rapture and all of that, who are probably even more supportive of Israel than even some Israelis, you know.
Well, maybe the issue is they see with the Iranian threat and so the bulwark for the West is Israel against...
That's not necessarily contradictory. I mean, that is true. You know, Israel, for all of its flaws, it has an important place to play in the
world.
It's prepared to fight. But it still doesn't justify what has happened in Gaza. They were entitled after October 7 to respond and to respond viciously. There's no country in the world that would have behaved differently. But the solution to the problem cannot be the levelling of Gaza. Like, that just simply, what do you do with 2.5 million people, you know? And you see the way in which Israeli public opinion has split. And you look at Haaretz, the liberal newspaper, which has been extraordinarily brave in terms of its reporting and interviewing IDF soldiers coming out of Gaza who are saying that it is basically a free-for-all. You find children to kill. And the whole brutalization that's taking place of Israeli military and Israeli society. None of that. They were entitled to retaliate. And there's no doubt about that. Hamas is a terrorist organization and a vicious one. And we need to constantly mention that. But there still has to be some degree of proportionality in your response. And there has been no proportionality in the Israeli response.
Okay, you're listening to The Anton Savage Show with me, Ivan Yates. I'm talking to Mark Hennessy, Philip Ryan and Francis Fitzgerald. We're going to move away from politics, look at prospects for 2025 and what other stories in the Sunday papers caught our eye. That's next.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
I've been filling in for Anton today in the company of Mark Hennessy, Philip Ryan and Francis Fitzgerald. Now, I've just received from the Taoiseach's office a statement saying that Simon Harris got out of his bed and he spoke to the National Emergency Coordinating Group, blah, 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 and he's going to have a week of this. Eilish O'Hanlon has an interesting piece on the back page about this nanny state-ism weather hoax.
You just because Dublin only has rain today, you think the rest of the country is the same.
No, Wexford, it starts in the capital of Europe.
Some people are snowed under. But she has a very funny article, actually. She said, remember when we used to have this thing in Ireland called winter? And she says, we no longer have winters. They're multi-weather hazard events, to use Met Aaron's language. This weekend, and that sensible precautions need to be taken to deal with adverse weather conditions goes without saying. But she says expecting the government to leap into action every time it snows only plays into politicians' psychological need to be seen as heroes. Now, that's a bit harsh, I think. Yeah, I mean, it is bad in some parts of the country.
But the great news is, for people who live in the real world, unlike the four of us, the Man U, Anfield, probably Liverpool, destroying United,
is going ahead.
And Nace races is going as well. So, like, the important things in life are happening.
I mean, like, I remember from my Tonight days, the ratings for, you know, a programme totally dedicated to Storm Emma or whatever would go off the Richter scale of over 200,000. And it sells newspapers.
Yeah,
as well.
It's the exact same online. The viewership goes up. People are obsessed with it. Like, I'm supposed to be going off for a few days tomorrow up north. And we were hitting
I'll give us a break.
No,
so people have taken two weeks off and you're taking another.
I was ringing the hotel saying, because I met Aaron and all these things, going, what happens if there is snow? And they were like, it's up to you. Like, you can make your own way up.
The other thing Eilish says, which I think is a hoot, she says, it's since been shown that giving a bad weather event a name conditions people into thinking that it's worse than it is.
Mark, you have Cork ancestry.
I wonder if you're listening south of Nace, I wonder how many of them are looking out the window and either thinking that we're incredibly prescient or completely.
That's what I say, though. You know? Ivan is totally dumb. You know,
judging by the weather radar that I looked at on the way in, certainly there are parts of the country that are having bad days. And I know in my own county of Cork, there are stories about people abandoning cars in some places. Now, I don't know how widespread.
You're bringing the voice of reason into this discussion.
They shouldn't have driven in the first place.
But equally, there is a question that does need to be considered about naming storms and all the rest of it. And that point about conditioning people is undoubtedly true. And we have reached a point where weather forecasters are damned if they do and they're damned if they don't.
That is true. You
know? Yeah. A lot of it is ass covering as well, though, isn't it?
Okay, like what stories caught your eye in the paper? And I'll give you a free rein because you were making the point that the Dermot Phelan acquittal on Friday in the Central Criminal Court isn't covered. Now, most Sunday papers go to bed on Friday morning. That might explain
it. I know, there is some pieces. There's a piece in the Mail, there's a piece in the Sunday Independent from some of the family members of Mr. Conlon, who unfortunately lost his life in the incident. And that shouldn't be forgotten. Like, there is family, there are people who are going to miss him, people who thought he was a good guy. And despite whatever record he may have had. But the two aspects from the case that stood out for me, and it is a fascinating case, is that number one, there seems to be an unwritten rule in this country because of not just this case, there's the Parknally case, there's another case where a guy had, I forget his name, someone came into his home and he killed him in his bedroom, that you can defend your home. There is a right there to defend your property, to defend your house. And if someone comes on there, it's at their own risk and you can do what you want. You might go before the courts, but juries in this country very much seem to see that your home is your home and you have a right to defend it. And then the other side of that is that, and look, this is all lawful, Mr. Phelan himself had quite the artillery in his house because he was a member of a gun club. The report seemed to suggest he had sniper rifles, he had shotguns, he had a handgun.
He used a Smith and whatever, a revolver.
Yeah,
to
a revolver.
Actually, you know, to fire these particular shots that resulted in the
extraordinary amount of guns to have in a house in a country where, for all intents and purposes, firearms are illegal.
But Irish law has always been so strong on property rights. Above kind of personal rights, if you like. You're defending your property.
It's in the Constitution.
It's
not just the property, because if you remember that case with the burglary, the man woke up with the burglar in the bedroom and defended himself.
So that's the one I was trying to
allude to. And there does, at that point, you're talking about right to life, right to property. Because what do you do in a situation like that? I mean, if you attack and you hit him or whatever, is he going to turn around then and kill you? So you are in a threat to life situation. It was striking. Just 2 points. One, on the Sunday papers, the lack of coverage is striking. The Saturday papers did much better. And for anybody who wants to read the best single piece on it, is written by my colleague Mary Carlin in the Irish Times yesterday. It's a stunning piece.
I actually read it online.
Stunning.
It's forensic.
Yeah.
It deals with every piece of technical evidence.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a witness magnificent evidence, piece. All that, Jack.
All of
that. Saying
but equally, sorry, just to make the point that I was making to you earlier, I was talking to people who had experience of that particular case in advance of Christmas. You know, this was maybe 4 or 5 weeks into the trial, and they said that there wasn't a prayer he was going to be convicted. convicted. So we as the general reader, might have been surprised by the outcome, but it doesn't seem to have come as a surprise to a lot of people who were dealing with the case.
The other thing that I just wanted to ask you about is a big story on domestic violence there. Like, I've lived in Wexford for the last 65 years, and I have never seen a three-month period where there's been four completely separate, even random murders. Is murder becoming common? You turn on the morning news and they say a woman, 58 years, has been found dead in a home in Roscommon or you know, wherever. What's this? What's the trend?
Well, it's shocking. I mean, violent end for seven women over past year. And of the cases resolved, all but 13% knew their attacker. It's not the stranger on the road, which is, you know, a feature of domestic and gender-based violence. There's no doubt domestic and gender-based violence is increasing. We are hearing of horrific murders. Now, the actual numbers per year are slightly going down in terms of women murdered, but, you know, every single
one. How can we prevent
it? Oh, it's a huge issue. It's a worldwide issue. I would say one of the key things we have to do at the moment is we have to get men more involved in speaking to younger men, in speaking out about this, in taking action. There's no one simple solution, but how is it acceptable that, you know, we have these murders, horrendous murders of women, as I say, seven over the past year. There's a huge amount we can do. I mean, prevention is key. I mean, I suppose I thought 30 years ago that by now, you know, with better education, men's increasing understanding, that this would decrease. In fact, it's pornography, it's drugs, it's alcohol is leading to these increases. So there's no one simple solution, but certainly we need more and more leadership, and I would say leadership from young men, from older men, from all men, to speak out about this, because it's mostly men who are doing this.
Any other stories? Like, I always try and look for new news, and the Sindo has a story of freedom of information about this housing scandal in University of Limerick, whereby they've had 1,000 pages of data showing that there was clear warnings and they went ahead and spent 5 million and wasted it.
Yeah, this is Wayne O'Connor, who's been deep diving into this now for months, if not years. And it seems a never-ending black hole of mismanagement of state funds down there. And it's extraordinary it's gone this far. And it feels that there's... Where does it end? Does it end in some sort of legal case? Is there going to be a tribunal? Like, it's extraordinary what's gone on down there.
Yeah. One third of trained GPs leaving the country is a report that's covered in a lot of papers. Like, why can't we have a rule? If we're going to spend 120 grand and educate you to be a doctor, that you might work for the HSC for 2 years, is that too much to ask?
I think that's a reasonable point. Although I do wonder if you were to go back over the last 50 years and looked at departures from Ireland after medical courses, would the numbers have been...
Was ever thus, is your point.
There was always a departure. And people do come back in a lot of cases. Now, obviously, all of that has been complicated by housing, because if you've got a job in Sydney or whatever, do you then come back and face into the Irish market? But there is an argument behind... requiring people who are getting extremely expensive medical education of all forms that they should do some sort of time in return. But could I go back just for a moment to Francis's thing? Because if you look at a story on violence against women, if you look at the killings that have taken place in the Republic and also in Northern Ireland, and look at it as a whole, it is definitely a crisis. It is not something that affects every man, because I know from my own contacts with friends and younger women, their relationships with younger males are aeons better than would have been the case 40 years ago. So there's a huge amount of things that are happening in terms of male-female relationships that are vast amongst the younger population, that are vastly better than they were when I was 18. So we do have to concentrate that. But the bit that is worse is an awful lot worse. And that is fueled by pornography, by drugs, by a whole variety of other things. And we do have to get to a point, and there's been a number of cases, particularly in the north, where people committed violence after having previously been in court. It's very, very simple. Lay a finger on a woman, you are going to jail. And it should be as simple as that. There should be no examples where it happens otherwise. And you should also have a situation where every young woman should be properly trained in self-defense.
The big, big issue, of course, in 2025, and we've only a minute left, so I'll take up most of that minute, is the is the presidency. Michael D is in his last year. I'll start with you, Philip. Who is our next president? Is the question I'm going to ask each of you. We have literally.
Would you put your hand forward yourself?
No.
All right.
No. They can't afford me. Go on. Yeah.
Well, I think the person may not have emerged or is sitting in this room.
Okay. Well, you're covering every heart there, Mark.
I go for it.
None of the mentioned candidates, I think. And I would look for somebody who can play off Ireland's reputation for culture, etc. And that we make it into a different brand for the next
set. A kind of Irish ambassador for Irish culture. Yeah. Okay, for the diaspora and all of that.
Yeah.
There is the prospect of an agreed candidate for Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil, because they don't want to spend 300 grand on something that doesn't give them more power. What do
I'd
you
say
think?
It's unlikely there'd be an agreed candidate between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. I think both will want to, you know, put somebody forward. But I think, look, the list will be long. That's one thing we know. You know, it's going to be like the Europeans and the locals.
God help the candidates, because there'll be skeletons they're not even aware
Absolutely.
Of that will come
Absolutely.
Out of it. My sincere thanks to my A-rated panel, Mark Hennessy, Ireland and Britain editor with the Irish Times, Philip Ryan, political editor of the Irish Independent, and the ever-enduring Francis Fitzgerald of the political world.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.